Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, January 15th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm speaking this evening not from Hickory Valley, Tennessee, but from West Point, Tennessee, which is south of Nashville, from the farm of Franklin Sanders, who's joining us later this evening to do our monthly precious metals update. But first tonight, we're going to have money and markets. I want to talk about the Wall Street Journal's recent story on 401ks. There's a post on the blog that went out with the link went out with our message to subscribers. I'll also briefly touch on Obama's stimulus package, which I'm going to address again in early February. And then I want to address some of the great questions we've gotten during the Ask Catherine segment. So money and markets, are 401ks and IRAs really safe? Why are we having this conversation? Some of you may remember last October there was congressional testimony in Congress about what to do with 401ks and IRAs, and I think more so in response to the tremendous losses that many investors incurred in their 401ks and IRAs last year. And sometime in November and December, I don't remember exactly when, the Carolina Journal did an article that shot around the internet describing some of the testimony, including a proposal to turn 401ks and IRAs really into government-managed accounts managed by someone like the Social Security Administration. And I posted a link to the Carolina Journal up on the blog, but I really didn't take the discussion seriously. Some of the proposals discussed were not, certainly the one to have government management was not very well done, and it just didn't seem to be something to take seriously. But I noted it because what we've seen around the world, and I think this is another reason the conversations are coming up, what we've seen around the world is as countries lose their financial sovereignty, whether it was Russia in the early 90s or more recently we've seen in Argentina, we're watching a variety of parties grab private pension funds or meddle with private pension funds. One of the things that happened recently was Argentina grabbed some pension funds. There are links, again, up on the blog. And those articles set off the fear that as the financial situation at the federal government deteriorates significantly, could the United States lose financial sovereignty, and then would assets more or less controlled or regulated by the government be subject to these kinds of maneuvers? So the Argentina scare kind of set some people off. Well, what happened last week was there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. I linked to it from the post at the blog called Financial Coup d'Etats and 401ks. There was an article in the journal, and it started off with a paragraph describing an investor who had lost a great deal of money on her tax-deferred plan, and the implication seemed to be, the sort of the spin of the article, was that the reason investors lost so much on their 401ks and IRAs related to the fact that they were not competent to manage their own money, and if anything, naive. Now, seeing that spin in the Wall Street Journal was deeply concerning to me. What followed it was then a description of some of the testimony given in October, including the proposal for government-managed accounts, and it gave it far more credibility than it really deserved if you go back and look at the proposal. And so the combination of that presentation in the Wall Street Journal sort of rang a bell in my mind and said, is somebody floating a trial balloon? That's certainly what it looked like to me. And so I wanted to start this conversation. I don't think that 401ks and IRAs are currently at risk. We're going to talk later with Franklin Sanders about what could happen with the U.S. dollar this year. My greatest concern is if we start to see significant deterioration in the U.S. dollar and we start to see real changes in and troubles in the economy that translate into trouble with the Treasury's ability to finance the United States, if the deficit currently projected to be $1.2 trillion plus the stimulus package now over $800 billion, so $2 trillion, can't translate into something that can be financed, Then we're talking about being in a congressional environment where, in theory, anything is possible. Now, when I say anything is possible, the most important issue for many of us is if we have an existing 401k or we have an existing IRA, would any proposal relate to our existing plans, or would they simply relate to new plans or new cash added to plans? And in one sense, it's inconceivable to me, it's much more probable that it would relate to plans going forward, not to existing plans. But again, I think the issue is if we get a serious deterioration this year, then all bets are off. I had kind of a squabble with an attorney the other day. We were discussing, in fact, what was possible in this vein, and she said, well, you know, touching the current IRAs or 401ks, because the people who have them are beneficiaries, would be unconstitutional. And I said, well, you know, if the country is dependent on its creditors, then in theory, all the assets within the country are subject to some kind of, not necessarily legal attachment, but if you look at the rules of taxation, then all assets are basically on the line. And we started to go around and around. But I want to remind everyone, I'm a member of the board of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and we had gotten so many questions about a year or two ago about the possibility of confiscation of gold that we wrote a letter to Treasury, it's up on the GATA website, and said, you know, do you reserve the right to confiscate gold? And they wrote back and said, we reserve the right to confiscate everything. It's pretty chilling. So I think it's important to remember that if the United States loses its financial sovereignty, and we have lost it as an economic matter, but that has not yet translated into a complete loss of its financial sovereignty. If that should happen, anything is possible. So I wanted to bring this to your attention because I intend to watch the rules related to 401ks and IRAs much more closely. Now, typically, most 401ks are the investor has to choose between options that that are defined by the employer or the employer's plan, and can't take the money out unless they leave the employment. For many years, usually there were enough options to make it possible, if the market was changing or the world was changing, to reposition yourself. What we're finding more and more is that many of these plans really don't have choices that will allow you to reposition or reposition quickly, and that really is a matter of concern. If you can't take it out, if you're still with the employer, you know, nothing to be done. But to the extent that it can be converted into an IRA or something where you have complete control and self-direction, there's a lot more flexibility. We're going to talk a little bit more with Franklin about what you can do if you have an IRA and want to get out of this, you know, a brokerage account and into something more tangible. So again, I think that this is an issue that it pays for us to watch. I want to watch it closely this year. The big variable that could shift things is a real deterioration in the federal credit. One of the reasons that when the Carolina report came out, I didn't take it as seriously is, as others did, is if you look at how much money has been lost in 401ks and IRAs this year, and if you look at how much of that I attribute to different mechanisms that relate to financial fraud with government complicity, it seems to me that a variety of parties have figured out a way to confiscate a significant portion of the assets inside of a 401k and IRA without having to make any overt moves legally on the mechanism itself. So I would just note again that probably the important thing this year is to make sure your 401k or IRA, if at all possible, is properly positioned in terms of what it's in. Again, not necessarily pulling it out of the 401k and IRA. So those are the comments on those, and I would really encourage our subscribers, if you note or see anything, whether it's a trial balloon in a place like the Wall Street Journal or indication that anyone in Congress is holding testimony or anything like that, we'd love to hear about it. So keep us posted if you see things, and I'll try and make sure that the links get put up on the blog or post them on the blog. But I think it would behoove us all to keep a watchful eye and be scouts for each other on this issue. Okay, the Obama stimulus package. I took a serious look at the Obama stimulus package last week, and it's been evolving. Paul Volcker, who is the chairman of the President-elect's Recovery Board, just announced a plan that the group of 30 of which he chairs had come up with a plan to re-engineer the financial system. And the bottom line is simply more centralization. It's a little bit, it looks like a shock and sort of a shock doctrine kind of plan. I'm going to talk a lot more about it in February after I've had a chance to look at it very deeply. But let me give you a couple of thoughts as we're starting to see and debate this idea of spending $800 billion on infrastructure and sort of a Christmas tree of issues. So comments on the stimulus package, a couple of things. The critical issue on any governmental infrastructure program, in theory, is we borrow a dollar and we invest a dollar in infrastructure. The question is, can that investment cause people or the life in a community or in an economy to be more productive in a way that can generate not just the dollar back, so return the original dollar, but create money to pay for the borrowing of the capital and then produce more? So, for example, I think some of you have heard me use the story that Peter Drucker once said that the GI Bill had the highest return on investment of any investment by the taxpayers in the 20th century. So a great infrastructure program can have a very positive return on investment, and the question is what's going to come out of the Washington Sausage Factory something that's politically engineered, or will it be politically engineered and also engineered to have what I call a positive or high return on total economic investment? So will it create value in the fundamental economy? And one of the things it needs to do that is really a vision of what is America, what are the industries in America that make us great, what are the industries that have a future, where can we add value as an economy and as a part of the world? And so I'm going to be looking at it from that vantage point. As of yet, what we've seen come from the president-elect and his transition team is really a Christmas tree. It doesn't really have any kind of vision or any performance metrics on how you would judge total economic value, but it's still early. So I'm going to be watching that because that pot of money is going to be very important. I just noticed this morning in my county, I was reading the local paper, and we had a long article that showed all the young, tall, strong, healthy young people who are going to jail and prison for drug dealing. And then it talked about how we hope to get two new schools constructed from the stimulus package. But there was no discussion of how, instead of having these kids end up as drug dealers, we could bring up healthy, strong kids to do something productive. So you can build all the schools you want, but if all your kids are dealing drugs, it's not going to help. So these are the questions I want to talk about in the stimulus package, and I think they're important because if we as a nation waste another $800 billion on just more political fraud and corruption, then things are going to turn in a very different direction than they might otherwise. Okay, so Ask Catherine. We've gotten some incredible questions, and I want to focus tonight on the ones that got the most votes from you. If you don't feel like leaving questions, you can always vote as well and vote for other people's questions. One of the questions, not surprisingly, was, is it time to liquidate 401ks and IRAs? One of the things it's important to understand when you look at this question is each person and their situation is different. So whereas it might be more attractive for one person or one household, it's completely different. So it's very hard to address this kind of issue generically. But what I would say is it's time to start to watch the political risk issues, but I don't think they're upon us yet. Now, obviously, for myself, I've chosen not to have an IRA, and Saleri doesn't have a 401k and is not going to. But again, situations vary widely. And the benefits of these plans can be enormous, not just the tax advantages, but also in many instances they're protected from creditors and from bankruptcy. And in this environment, that could be a very attractive feature. Another question is ETFs, are there any I recommend in this environment? Now, one of the things it's important to reiterate again and again, I'm not going to give investment advice on the Saleri report. And partly, again, it's because everybody's different and different portfolios are different and different family situations are different. Generally, I'm not a fan of ETFs in the sense that I like investing in things that are real. So if you don't buy, say, precious metals coins, you buy into an entity that has real assets, real hard assets, and is doing something really useful. A lot of the ETFs are, it's questionable whether they have the real assets. You have servicers who are the same large financial institutions who lied about the last 20 issues. Why would you trust them on this? Or they're investing in futures, so it's really a paper play. And I think, as I discussed last week in the when I described the rules of avoiding financial fraud, when you deal in securities or investments like that, it is very important to keep it as a small part of your portfolio. There are times when they make for very useful hedges that will work in a slow burn scenario, but of course when things really, if we get a worst case scenario or a serious depression scenario, that's when those arrangements tend not to hold up. So again, you know, there's something that is not should not be major, and there's something to be used, but with care. Finally, the third question, great question, is why is the dollar so high? And that's exactly where I'd like to start my conversation tonight with Franklin Sanders, since I've had Franklin on the Saleri Report, and we've done audio seminars, and y'all are familiar with him. But Franklin is a precious metals dealer. He's a farmer. He's a minister. He has just a beautiful, fantastic family, and so he wears many hats. He writes a wonderful newsletter, which is really my favorite newsletter, The Money Changer. And so, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. We want to talk to you, Franklin, about your energy. Are you on TVA?
Yes, we are on TVA.
Yeah, so are we, and so Franklin and I are feeling the coal sludge. Anyway, so Franklin, why is the dollar so high?
Well, you know, Catherine, I think one of the things, one of the fundamental things you have to understand about the dollar's exchange rate is that it's a fixed game. To a very, very large extent, it's a fixed game.
Right.
Once a month at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, all the heads of the central banks or their representatives get together, and you know they don't sit around and talk about how good the filet mignon is. they sit around and talk about how they're going to help each other, how they're going to work together. So it's a rigged game to begin with. But whatever you see the dollar doing, and it's very hard to judge technically because the government throws these surprise parties. It's not like a market where you know you're just seeing market forces at work and you can look at the chart and the chart tells you something. But the long-term decline of the dollar has not been reversed by any means at all. And I just don't see politically or from a policy standpoint how the U.S. can continue or can reinstitute a strong dollar policy. And you know, if you look at just from a technical standpoint, and I know I just said that technically you can't really trust the charts with the dollar, but from a technical standpoint, the dollar really hasn't done anything. In fact, it went up to 88 or so, and then it failed at 88 and dropped back down. Well, if you look at the way it went up in a straight line, and markets that go up in a straight line go down in a straight line, and that's exactly what it did. So just from looking at the chart, you can't see any plans for a strong dollar policy in the chart. Now, again, that's subject to surprise parties, so you don't know what'll happen.
I think part of the challenge is for many Americans or people in North America, we've grown up thinking of the dollar as our currency, whereas for the last 20 years, it's really become the reserve currency. And the games that we're watching are not just the games of the U.S. Central Bank and Treasury; it's the games of G8 out of the Bank of International Settlements. So this is a global game, and it's a global taxation system. And essentially, it's a game whereby the insiders are manipulating the outsiders, but the insiders are not just Americans. It's you've got central banks worldwide.
Right, and that exchange rate is set not for the benefit of Americans, but for the benefit of all those parties.
Right.
And the last person they consider is you.
Right. It was so hard for me to explain to people in Hickory Valley that the hedge funds were borrowing dollars from the Japan Central Bank, or the hedge funds could go to the Japan Central Bank and borrow for 0%, and people in Hickory Valley were financing their businesses with their credit cards for 23%. So they just couldn't fathom. Well, but it's very interesting. If you look at Obama's stimulus package, he's capping. They're going to put a cap back on credit card interest rates. Do you know the cap that they're proposing?
No.
36%.
Oh, of course.
Well, but here we are. We're loaning the Fed funds rate at 0%, so we're loaning to banks at 0%, and they can turn around and reloan to Americans for 36%.
Right. Well, that's a good deal. It's good work if you can get it. That's the kind of thing I like. But I think, one of the mistakes that people make is that they get this idea that there's a lockstep relation between the dollar and gold and silver. And the dollar is only one of the factors, the dollar's exchange rate is only one of the factors that influences the price of gold. Far more important, I think, in the long run, now perhaps not in the short run, but in the long run, far more important is what the public's perception of the dollar's future expectations are.
Right.
And you the money system today is a confidence game.
Right.
It is built on confidence. And whenever any significant portion of the public begins to lose confidence, then that exchange rate is going to change. And that's not something that central banks can fiddle with at the margin, because it's huge. Groundswell demand, and that will change the exchange rates. Now, what we've seen in the last 5 months is particularly meaningful to me, and that is we have seen what I can't term as anything but a buying panic into gold and silver. I've been doing this 28 years, and I've never seen a market like this where the supply chain was completely cleaned out.
Has it remained that way through December and into January? Or?
Well, it's begun to ease a little bit. In the middle of December, it began to ease a little bit, and there's much more product available. But also, prices are higher than they were in November and December.
Right.
And so that's brought some supply out. But it's really a scary prospect. I mean, in 28 years of being in business, I have never before seen a time when I could not pick up the phone and make one phone call and get, $500,000 worth of gold and silver within a week.
Right.
And now, in November, we saw supply times on some items stretched out to 8 and 12, even 16 weeks. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is I think that points to a groundswell of public demand. And this is only the beginning. You have to remember this is very, very early in the bull market.
Right.
And there are not a lot of people that have caught on yet. And so this is just the beginning of that third wave up that will be so strong and last so long and be so crazy. So I think it's good to bear in mind that the dollar is not the sole determinant of demand for gold and silver.
Right. Well, one of the things, when we say dollar is high, what we're saying, the dollar is high against other fiat currencies that are behaving in equally ridiculous, if not more ridiculous, ways.
We're not saying the dollar is high in historical terms.
Right.
If you look back to the 1980s when the dollar index was up around 230, the dollar at 80 is, a third of that. And if you look at the high, the recent high, last recent high was in 2001 at 120 on the dollar index. And you know, there's still this balance of payments problem. And it's long been my opinion that the Bush administration, the powers that be, determined that they were going to solve the balance of payments problem by letting the dollar depreciate. And it's gone. It went from 120 down to 70. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that was quite a drop.
Yeah, it's a huge drop. And you know, whereas you can't really translate that directly into your own purchasing power, it does say that it's gone from 120 to 70, and that's a huge drop.
Now, remember, the engineer or the architect, there were two architects of the sort of the strong dollar policy, which I would say included the gold suppression scheme and the housing bubble, and one was Bob Rubin and one was Larry Summers, and Larry Summers had written an academic treatise on how you could prop up the dollar by suppressing the price of gold. We've got the study, you know, that was done long before the policy was implemented up on the GATA website. And Larry Summers is returning to the seat of power this next Monday. He's going to be the National Economic Advisor.
Right, and Robert Rubin has been one of the strongest supporters of Barack Obama.
Right, and is leaving Citibank, and we're wondering where he might pop up.
We're sort of wondering with nervousness where he might pop up.
I wanted to mention, I just finished reading Sprott Asset Management's. They're a firm in Canada which has been very bullish on gold, and they published a sort of review of what to expect in 2009. And one of the things they did was they're very bullish on gold for 2009. They put up little charts of how gold had performed in other currencies. So when measured in the dollar, gold rose 4% for 2008. Can you guess how much it rose in Australian currency?
A lot more, I would think.
27%. Now, here's the trick question. Can you guess how much it rose in Icelandic currency?
Oh, my goodness.
95%.
Whoa.
And I think one of my theories as to part of what's driving the demand is when people see what happened in Iceland and are reminded of what happened in Europe in the before World War II. What's funny is people who swore to me that they would never, ever buy physical gold are now coming back to me saying, now, can I listen to that audio seminar? And how do you do this? And it's suddenly shifted the whole discussion. You know, there literally is a paradigm shifting.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's going to be the interesting part of 2009. Because you're right, very few people own gold. It's a very thin market, although the ETFs have exploded. But
the physical market is so tiny.
Right.
And I had that, you know, I suppose I ought to have known that. But when I would pick up the phone and I'd say, well, what about American Eagles? Don't have any. They're 8 weeks out. What about Maple Leafs? No, they're 8 weeks out too. What about Kruger Inns? Don't even think about those. You know, and I'm having to wait for people to ship coins from Europe in order to have something something to sell. It points out how terribly thin that market is.
Right.
I have literally done things in the last 2 months that I've never done before in business.
Well, I know somebody told me that Franklin Sanders recommended a silver bar. I said, what? What?
We couldn't get anything else. You know, I've sold 1,000-ounce silver bars. They're clumsy. They're heavy. They're hard to deal with. But there was nothing else to buy at anything like a reasonable price. And it's the same way with gold bullion. You know, normally I'd rather have coins. But I've sold kilos of gold, you know, 32.15-ounce bars of gold, because there was nothing else available.
Wow.
And I think, you know, what this really warns me about is you have to be there ahead of time. You cannot wait. You cannot think, oh, well, there'll always be time to get out. I'll always be able to do that. You may not be able to. And so you have to have your position in place, and you have to do it in time.
Right, and it takes time to learn about these things. So I really think, you know, it's always, once you know you're going to need to do it, the time is now certainly to start learning about it. But if you're going to buy coins, you know, you want to get that behind you as soon as possible.
Right. And again, the, you know, the importance of the coin form is that you can take those gold coins and you can go anywhere in the world with them, literally anywhere in the world, and you can negotiate them.
Right.
And
it's a global currency.
Right. It is the one world currency.
Right.
And so for that reason, I think, you know, everybody ought to, they ought to consider where they are now.
Well, you know, it's been my thesis since about 2001 that I think the reason that, one of the reasons that the gold price has been suppressed is I think there is a real push to get the gold sold by central banks and governments, get out of their hands and into private hands. Because if you're going to re-engineer governance, then you've got to have the gold out of whatever. You can't destroy the financial sovereignty of something if it's got a big stockpile of gold.
No, but isn't that the story of privatization around the world?
Right.
That they take assets that were public assets and they convert them to private assets and they put them into the hands of insiders.
Right, but you want to do that at below market prices. And in fact, there are a couple of newsletter writers who take the case that process is not over, and they expect to see gold get pushed way down, because one of the big pieces is the IMF gold. And the gold, you know, occasionally the IMF will announce it's going to sell gold, and suddenly gold drops way down, and they don't sell it.
Right.
So one of the big overhangs is will the IMF, if the IMF did dump its tonnage on the market this year, and a way was found because the economy was deteriorating to threaten other countries and central banks to sell theirs, could you push the price down again this year? And I would say yes, I think you can.
It would take a lot of selling.
Well,
I mean, I'm not saying that they couldn't do it, but it would take an awful lot of selling.
Yeah,
You know, the IMF thing in particular has been a repeated red herring that they've dragged across the market, and it's like, if you're a long-term gold watcher, it's, you know, when you hear the IMF, you go, oh, no, not that thing again. Are they
right,
going to bring...
people who are new in the market don't know that it's, you know, the same old, same old.
Oh, well,
and they, you know, there's a panic.
It's exactly like the red herring about silver that, oh, they're not going to use silver in photography anymore, so the price is going to disappear. And, you know, after you've seen it a while, you get to the point where you're...
Speaking of which, the gold-silver ratio takes my breath away. Could you explain to everyone what the gold-silver ratio is and trading the gold-silver ratio and where the ratio is right now and why I find it so breathtaking?
Well, it's breathtaking because we had an established trend. You have to look at the very long term, and the ratio was under 16 to 1 for all of human history until 1873. And then there was an engineered demonetization of silver around the world, and the ratio went up and down, but it went back to 16 to 1 during World War One, and then it climbed up, thanks to Roosevelt's machinations in the market, it climbed up to 100 to 1 in 1941. It dropped then again to 16 to 1 in 1967. And when I say 16 to 1, I mean it only took 16 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. And then rose again and then dropped below 16 to 1 in 1980 at the peak in the gold market. Then from 1980 until 1991, you had a long uptrend when the ratio rose to 100 to 1 again in 1991. So, and you had a double peak in 1991 and 93, about 100 to 1. So now we've got this established downtrend in the market, and it will, you know, if history proves any guide, it will go back to 16 to 1. Well, it had gone down to, it had gone up to 82 to 1, and then it went back down to 43 to 1. And if you think about that, that's about a 50% swing.
Right.
And what we can do by swapping back and forth between silver and gold is we buy silver with gold when gold is cheap. So when an ounce of gold buys 80 ounces of silver, we swap gold for silver. And then when an ounce of silver only, when an ounce of gold only costs 40 ounces of silver, we go back the other way, and we double the number of ounces of gold that we
have. And it's really a way of ending up with more and more gold without putting out more cash.
Well, exactly, and it's a way to take an investment that basically is sterile, that doesn't pay a dividend or interest, and make it grow while you're waiting for the price to go up. So it's a little hard for most people to understand because they're not used to doing that kind of spread trading. But once they grab it, you know, once we've done a complete round, once we've gone from gold to silver and back into gold, and they've got 50% more ounces than they started with, you don't have to explain anything after that.
It's worth running down to the post office and mailing them off.
Oh, yeah, and the trades. We don't do the trades but once every, two, maybe 3 years. So it's very much worth doing the trade.
One of the best speeches I ever heard was James Turk did, you know, sort of that long historical view and showed the bull markets back and forth between what he would call a bull market in financial assets and then a bull market in tangibles, and precious metals would be tangibles, other commodities.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you know, bank paper versus real things.
Mm-hmm.
And what he showed is that you know the tangible market is peaked when 1 ounce of gold buys the Dow.
Right, exactly.
And what his question was is gold going to have to go to 8,000, or is the Dow going to have to go, you know, down to 800?
Well, one of the things that I keep trying to get my subscribers to understand is that you have to stop looking at things in dollar terms. You know, the dollar for most of us is what is technically called the numeraire. It's the denominator in the fraction that we look at the world with, and we think of everything in terms of dollars. But you have to stop doing that in an atmosphere where the dollar has no enduring value. If you do that, then you're going to be fooled about what the value is. For instance, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 2007 went to 14,000, and everybody thought that was wonderful because the previous high had been in January of 2000 at 11,722. Well, if you adjust that 11,722 for inflation to 2007, it comes out to 14,000.
Right.
So you didn't make anything. But if you grade it in gold, then you see that the Dow went from about 38 ounces of gold to about 15 ounces of gold.
Now, I agree with you, but it took me years, Franklin, when I decided, okay, I've got to switch and stop thinking in the dollars and start thinking in real things. And they're trying to use all this paper to trick me into holding paper while they buy all the real things up cheap. Because it's not just gold, it's land, it's water, it's, you know, basically, you know, we're running around in this crazy paper while they're buying up all the real stuff.
Absolutely.
So I tried to do it, and it took me years. And then literally, one day I woke up and I had converted. But to this day, I don't know how to turn around and explain to someone else how to do it.
Well, the wealth of the world comes of the things that men dig out of the ground. And,
right.
You know, whether that's agriculture or whether that's mining, the fact is that's where the wealth starts. That's where we get wealth for free, so to speak. You know, if you're in agriculture, you take a bushel of seeds and you throw it in the ground, and then for nothing more but sunlight and rain, you get 100 times as many seeds. And, you know, mining is something the same thing. It's not sustainable. It doesn't replenish itself the same way. But that's where the riches of the world come from. And it's always been interesting to me.
And I would say from intelligence.
Well, intelligence applied to those things.
Tools.
Certainly.
We make tools.
Yeah. But it's always been interesting to me that, you know, the Rothschilds, who are probably the most famous financial family in the world, the flagship of their holdings is a company called RTZ, used to be Rio Tinto Zinc, but it's now called RTZ, and it owns everything in the world.
Right.
Physical things. You
right.
know, mining, all sorts of production from the earth. So I think if they look at the world that way, maybe I ought to think about looking at the world that way, too.
Well, that was the scary things when ETFs first came out, because mm-hmm. what happened was you saw finally the interest in precious metals go beyond a few people.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, you know, all the same old are creating these vehicles and saying, do it this way. And, of course, if they're buying paper but the gold isn't really there or it's being used for something else,
mm-hmm.
then there's no competition in the physical market for the insiders to control.
Right. Well, you know, the Latin proverb, timeo danaos et Don Aferentes.
I really don't know that one, frankly.
I fear the Greeks even when they come bearing gifts. And so when suddenly I find Wall Street on my side, it makes me very, very nervous.
Okay, one of the questions we have gotten again, and I think it's really important to go over, is numismatics. Mm. You recommend never, ever, ever buying numismatics, and maybe you could go over why.
Well, in the first place, they have not in the last, since 1998, which is about a 10-year track record, we've been in a new bull market in gold and silver since 2001. And since 1998, numismatics have actually lost value against bullion, and they have lost substantial value against bullion. Now, when I say they've lost value against bullion, what I mean is that just buying gold bullion-type items, gold coins, gold bars, has outperformed buying numismatic coins. And you have to think about what is driving the gold and silver markets now. It's monetary demand. And monetary demand does not care about collector value. Monetary
right.
demand just simply wants to hedge the risk of owning dollars. So I think this time around, as opposed to the bull market that peaked in 1980, you are not going to see great increases in numismatic coins. And let me explain something else to you about numismatic coins. And this is, it's a little bit personal to me. They mark those coins up about 45%.
Right.
And they pay so that they can pay about a 25% commission on them. And I have had so many people come to me who have put substantial money into numismatic portfolios. And when I say substantial money, I mean $50,000, $100,000, $150,000. And they come to me and they say, what is this worth now? So I go to dealers that I trust and I say, what will you give us for this? And I have to go back to these people and say, you know, what you spent $125,000 for is now worth $83,000. And that's a bitter experience. I don't
right.
like doing that. But the fact is that the markup is so great from the very beginning.
Hey, give me those numbers again. It was...
Well, they mark them up about 45% over... Now, you know, this is a generalization.
I thought you said 25,000 up to 83,000.
No. What I'm saying is that I have had people who spent $125,000.
Okay.
And then I have to go back to them and say, you've lost nearly half of your original
okay,
investment.
So here's one of the most important issues. If somebody is currently holding numismatics, should they take the loss on them now and swap them in for bullion?
Well, there are two reasons why they should do that.
Okay.
The first reason is they can take a tax loss. They can take the tax loss when they sell the numismatics. The second reason is because of the nature of the drop in the last 5 months, we have seen gold drop very, very fast, and numismatic coins have not dropped as fast. So what that means is that we've seen the opposite of the pattern of the last 10 years in the last 4 months. So numismatic coins have actually gained value against bullion.
So now's a good time to swap.
So now is a very good time to swap because the premiums are high. And so this is the time I would swap, because once gold begins to go again, and probably this year you'll see gold above $1,200, something like that, then those premiums will disappear on the numismatic coin.
Now, if you bought numismatics from a numismatics dealer, should you sell back to them?
You know, what I always tell my customers is, look, I'm going to go at least to two places, two wholesalers that I trust, and I'm going to get bids from them. I'll give you those bids, and you go back to the numismatic dealer that you bought them from, and you see what they'll give you for them.
Right.
And take the best offer you can get.
Right.
Because, you know, that only makes sense. But generally, they're not as numismatic dealers are not as enthusiastic about buying as they are about selling. It's a kind of a rule that I found works.
Now, it's interesting because one of the things I run into a lot is the notion that, the idea of buying gold is it's a stupid investment, because if the economy really deteriorates, then what I need is land and water. you know, in a farm, I don't need gold.
Mm.
Now, you're an interesting case study because you're both a farmer and a precious metal dealer.
Mm.
And I would love to hear your comment on the merits of precious metals versus farmland.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a lot easier to buy gold than it is to build a farm. I can promise you that, especially if you don't know anything about it. But, you know, I always tell people, look, your best investment is whatever you do for a living. And I believe that because if you have a small business or a business of any size, you know more about that than anybody else in the game.
Right.
And so that's where your greatest profits are going to be. You know how to employ your capital to the greatest return. But not all of us have our own business. Not all of us, you know, have a way to spend money in our own business and cause it to grow. So for those people, you just have to go back to gold and silver, you know. And I encourage everybody. I know it makes me sound a little crazy, but I don't want to be living in a city in a time of economic turmoil, because economic turmoil can easily turn into physical violence.
Right.
And you don't want to be in that. You don't want to be in that place when that happens. The best way to avoid trouble is not to be where the trouble happens.
Right.
So, and you know, Catherine, a lot of people think, well, the sort of lifestyle that we've adopted. I have a big family. I have a lot of kids and who are grown now, but still, that makes it a lot easier to go live on a farm. But you know, the very best return Susan and I ever had on our efforts in a garden was in a city lot 100 by 150 feet.
Right.
We grew a garden in the flower beds, and we literally lived off of it for a year. So I think for most people, what I tell most people is if you live in the middle of a city, if you don't have to stay there, figure out some way to get out further into the country. And even if you've got a few acres, learn to grow a garden and, you know, scale down the cost of your living, and that'll be one of the best investments that you make.
You know, once upon a time, I keep coming back to this. Once upon a time, we invested our time and our money in creating the capacity for us to give us the things that we needed.
Mm.
And we've gone to a world where we invest our money with corporations or banks, and they give us a yield. And then we take that yield and we go buy products and services from corporations and banks. And the reliability of both flows is deteriorating. And so the challenge for each of us, and every person's situation is unique, is where can I disintermediate?
Absolutely.
And part of that disintermediation is learning how to think not in dollars but in real things, because if you look at the disintermediation opportunity and you say, I'm going to base it on price, then you're never going to take the time to learn to do what it is which is going to be profitable, and in part because it's so volatile. So, for example, you're never going to learn how to use biodiesel because every time you start to, because the price of oil's run up, boom, it runs down.
Mm.
And one of my theories on the volatility is it's very good at keeping people in their current paradigm. Because, for example, you know, I can show someone that gold has gone up steadily for the last 6+ years, but the volatility is so great. Even if it was up 4%, you know, last year, they'd rather be in the stock market that was down 35% because it's not as volatile.
Mm. Well, volatility is not the only issue. I think there's something else, too, and that is that every one of us knows that it's easier to throw money at things than it is to throw energy. You know, when it comes, Christmas is the perfect example. Christmas time comes, and you stop and think, oh, there are these people that I want to give a Christmas gift to. And usually you think, well, I'll allot so much money and so forth. But have you ever thought about allotting time? I mean, I'll admit I haven't done this in a number of years, but a few years ago, I took the time and sat down and did a calligraphy for every one of my children.
Uh-huh.
Just a little bitty, you know, little bitty small one. But I see those now, you know, hanging in their bathroom or hanging in their house, and I remember the time that I spent. I remember the energy that I put into it, and I'm much more pleased with that than I'm, you know, with any money gift that I've given them or anything that I bought them. So I think when we talk about changing the way that you live, we're talking about learning to do things instead of throwing money at something.
Right. It's a whole new way of thinking, and it integrates in a way. Well, let me ask you this. You and Susan left Memphis. You left downtown Memphis, and you moved into the country and taught yourself how to farm. What was it like?
Well, we killed a lot of animals at first. I mean, we didn't mean to, but unfortunately we did, and, you know, you learn from those mistakes. And we were very, very fortunate to have some people who told us, go slow, do a little bit at a time, take it in bites that you can digest, and that's what we've done. And there are huge resources out there. You know, people, the organic farming movement, organic gardening, all of those, you know, what you might call biodynamic farming has been around for a long, long time, and they're huge. They're huge.
Right. I've been working with a group of people on urban permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you and I tend to talk about the country because we live in the country, but there's a lot going on in the cities that's fantastic because there's a lot of land and there's about to be more available.
Well, again, you know, I mean, I like to tell the story about the year that we had that garden in Midtown Memphis, actually, in our flower beds. We had this strip of land right next to along the side of the lot that was next to a hedge, and nothing would grow there. So I turned it up and I planted sweet potatoes. And I literally, whenever I was out in the front yard, somebody would stop and ask me what that beautiful ornamental plant was that I planted on the side of the road. Well, I got 2 bushels of sweet potatoes out of that. So it's a change in the way you think. You have to turn your mind from money to wealth, and they're not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
You and I have an audio seminar called Building Real Wealth, which I try and get everybody to listen to because it's really, it steps back and it goes to the deeper issues of what's real and what's not and tries to get people out of the bubble economy. And I think, you know, it's funny. Somebody said to me today, he's into gold just now. You know, so this is, and this happens with everybody. Their first year is always a roller coaster. He said, "I just bought gold at 850, and now it's 815." You know, he and of course everybody who buys it knows that this could happen if you look at the chart. Mm. What do you tell somebody who is suddenly bought it last week at 850 and this week it's 815?
Well, I have to tell you that we just have been refurbishing our office, and I found a notebook that I used to keep that had charts in it.
Uh-huh.
And these were charts from 2001 and 2002, and I saw one where gold had gone from 320 to 340, and then it had backed off, and I had done all of these calculations trying to figure out where gold might go back to. Would it go back to 300, or would it go back to 305? And, you know, when I look back at that, I think, gosh, it just doesn't make that much difference.
Oh, I remember sweating those things.
Oh, goodness. I sweat the difference between 340 and 320 like I was giving birth. And you know, and now I look back at it and I think, well, that was silly. It doesn't make any difference because you know that you've got the primary trend going with you. You know you're on the right side of the primary trend, and so you just have to be patient. And after all, you know, the dollar's volatile too. You may look at it and say, "Well, it was 100 cents today, and it'll be 100 cents tomorrow." That's true, but what that 100 cents will buy goes up and down tremendously every day. So,
one of the scenarios I've talked about for the dollar this coming year, so the dollar could stay high, it could you know drop and get a little bit chaotic if the economic condition of the U.S. translates into the, you know, the behavior of the currency. But the other is a scenario that's getting more and more attention called radical devaluation. And maybe we could just take a minute and explain what that is and whether we think that is, you know, somebody drinking Kool-Aid or could really happen.
Well, what do you mean by radical devaluation? You mean that
Well, everybody goes to bed. It's a little bit like when Nixon took us off the gold standard. Everybody goes to bed, and they wake up the next morning, and gold has been revalued to 3,000 against the dollar. And, you know, and we've got a very different world.
Well, let me just say that for years and years, I've thought that was the end game. Because if you look back, the paper money game has been run roughly since the 1860s and more increasingly since 1913 when the Federal Reserve was founded. And now everyone more or less expects inflation. And so how can you fool the greatest number of people simply by reversing your feeling going the other way? But I don't think we're anywhere near a radical devaluation yet. The radical devaluation historically always comes after you've had a period of monetary chaos defined by hyperinflation.
Right.
And so, and usually that takes, you know, from 3 years at least to work out, where you get prices rising at a rate greater than 10% a month, and economic calculation becomes literally impossible. So I don't really see that for this year or even next year. I think the Fed is still roughly in charge. I think that will be the end game at some point, but I think that's years away.
Right. Well, think about it. If you use fiat currency to get control of all the real assets on the planet,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it make sense to switch to gold to keep somebody from stealing it back away from you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's the only place to go. Listen, I wanted to mention one other thing to your listeners, because I heard you talking about IRAs and 401ks. You can put gold and silver into IRAs. There are two trustees that do that in the country, Gold Star Trust and Sterling Trust, and you can actually put your gold and silver in that. There are some other things that you may be able to do if you have a 401k. The 401k may, it seldom happens, but they may offer a precious metals mutual fund whereby you can invest in precious metals stocks.
Right, and an IRA can also do gold money.
That's right, they can.
So you can do gold and silver. You can have an offshore account with an IRA.
Right. Another thing you can do with an IRA is you can buy a bear fund.
Right.
That is a fund that profits from shorting stocks. Now, usually they don't offer that option, but a few of them will.
Right. Okay, well, Franklin, thank you so much. You're going to be back next month, once a month, for our Precious Metals Update. And I can't tell you how much I appreciated you joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's always my joy. Thank you.
Night.
Night.
Okay, we're not going to have a Let's Go to the Movies tonight. I just wanted to briefly discuss before we close next week. We're going to do the complete Godfather series. So that's Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Godfather 3. The reason we have a Let's Go to the Movies component, I find if you really want to understand how the economy works, it really is all in the movies. You don't have to read hundreds of books and economic textbooks and boring academic articles. You can really you can see all of it in the movies. Every movie has, or the good movies have, maybe one or two pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. And of all the movies I've ever seen, the Godfather series is really without equal in explaining how our economy works. There are a couple of the most important points of what I would describe as the real deal that the Godfather is unique and compelling in explaining. So I'm going to do, we're going to have Money and Markets next week, but then the Solari Report is really going to be going through the Godfather series and explaining what it can teach you. If you get a chance to watch all of them, please do. The first two were great, were received with great critical acclaim and got many awards. And the third did not. The part of Michael Corleone's daughter, the casting fell apart, and the director's daughter ended up doing it. It was roundly criticized for it. But interestingly enough, Godfather 3 is the most useful in explaining sort of how the economy really works and how the world really works. So if you get a chance, watch the complete Godfather series. I love it, so I love watching 1, 2, 3 right in a row. Watch it. I think after you listen, you may want to watch some of it again. But it's very, very special. Sometimes we put Godfather quotes up on the blog. One of my favorites is already up there. It's Michael Corleone in Godfather 3 saying, "The higher I go, the crookeder it becomes." Anyway, so that's it for this evening. Thank you so much for being a subscriber to the Solari Report. We can't tell you, I can't express how excited everybody at Solari is about the Solari Report. We've gotten a great reception. And part of the great reception is you just wouldn't believe who's been coming into the blog. I thought I would just, as I close, mention some of our biggest users. I don't like to put this information up on the blog, but it's easy to talk about it. Let me just read some of our biggest users for this week. Yale University, Edward Jones, AT&T, Honeywell, BAE Systems, State of Ohio, Lockheed Martin, United Technologies, PNC, Citicor, Lucent Technologies, State Farm, U.S. Army, Government of Luxembourg, EDS, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, UBS, Drinker Biddle & Reath, the IRS, Kroger, State Street, the State Department, the State of Arkansas, the U.S. Post Office, the U.S. Navy, our old friend who's on every week, Federal Reserve Bank, another old friend who's on all the time is Goldman Sachs, the U.S. Air Force, AIG, J.P. Morgan Chase, and ATK, so the big banks, the big defense contractors, partly because I posted a post about the Defense Department, the fellows who were the chief financial officer and controller of the chief financial officer of the Pentagon and controller of the Air Force were appointed last week by Obama to return to defenses in the number two and number three position. So it doesn't surprise me that we have a lot of big defense contractors reading that this week. Anyway, you're in our prayers. We look forward to being with you on Thursday, February 5th, when we take a deeper look at the new administration stimulus package and talk with Albert Bates about transition towns and financial permaculture. So until then, remember our motto, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.